Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Big Bend Sentinel for Thursday, October 28th, 2021. As tourism remains steady, Marfa struggles to attract service industry professionals. By Mary Cantrell, MKCANTRELL at BigBendSentinel.com. Marfa. The city of Marfa, like many cities around the country, is experiencing a shortage of service industry professionals to help keep restaurants, gas stations, and other vital businesses operational. Many businesses are significantly understaffed and, despite solicitation, are not receiving a healthy number of job applicants. The local deficit of available service industry professionals reflects a nationwide trend of service workers seeking more sustainable employment outside of the industry in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic. Mike Rodriguez, general manager of the smaller Stripes gas station on the west side of town, said he is currently seeking two more full-time employees or 3 to 4 part-time sales associates to help run the business, but only one application for the job has been submitted in the past 4 months. John Ward, general manager of the larger Stripes on the east side of town, is also experiencing staffing shortages. Both managers are relatively new to their roles and often have to work 16 to 17 hour days in order to keep the stores open. "They're really wanting my particular location to go back to 24 hours," said Ward. "But right now I can't do that because I don't have enough staff. And you're trying to find that right person that's going to work the night shift. That plays a factor as well." In addition to operating gas pumps and convenience store aspects of the businesses, both locations also have food programs they need to hire staff to help operate. They are offering above minimum wage. One job listing said $11 per hour to help operate the sandwich shop, and are able to raise pay for people with experience. Rodriguez said most people he tries to recruit are not interested in working so closely with the public or have restructured their lives due to COVID and may be working as a full-time child care provider, for example. "We're still in the pandemic. It hasn't ended. A lot of people are still leery," said Rodriguez. "One minute we're the hero for being open during COVID, but then when we go to use the restroom, we're getting chewed out. It's a tough situation dealing with the public." Rodriguez said it is hard for Stripes as an employer to compete with larger entities also actively hiring, like the Texas Department of Transportation or American Electric Power, who are willing to train people and able to offer higher wages. Darby Hillman, former employee of Stellina and the Lost Horse, lived in Marfa for 6 years and left the service industry in March 2020 to pursue further education. Despite getting along well with co-workers, after years of being on her feet all day, liaising with customers and keeping up with the pace of the restaurant in her role as a cook, Hillman said she was burnt out. When the pandemic hit and the sort of sense of community dissipated, it gave me the opportunity to really reflect on how my life had been operating for the years that I had been in service. I realized that I was really unhappy and that it was a really sort of punishing job," said Hillman. "I think a lot of the places that service industry workers could potentially afford to live have been bought up and turned into hotel situations. It's just an extremely expensive place to live now. The service industry is notoriously low-paying for really hard work. I think that's the number one challenge for a lot of people, said Hillman. In addition to the shrinking labor pool and lack of affordable housing, the pandemic contributed to health and safety concerns of service industry workers, said Hillman, who are oftentimes serving visitors from out of town who arrive with preconceived notions. There was a certain degree of entitlement among the tourists during the pandemic when we were really trying to be very careful. At least many of us were. There was an attitude of, where is everyone? Why is everything closed? Said Hillman. Jeremiah Tijerina, who grew up in Alpine, is currently working two jobs at Riata Restaurant in Alpine and the Water Stop in Marfa. Tijerina was attending Texas State University in San Marcos, but decided to put his education on hold and move back home when classes went fully online. He said he works two jobs because while one offers a higher income, the other allows him to socialize with people from all over the U.S. I pretty much chose to work in Marfa to be around more like-minded people and just having the opportunity to really connect with individuals from different places, said Tijerina. In addition to working events like the Trans-Pecos Festival, Tijerina said he also finds the constant influx of out-of-towners to be a pleasant part of his jobs in the service industry. More tourists mean more customers at the restaurant, which means more tips for me, said Tijerina. I enjoy hearing different walks of life and gaining different perspectives on where people come from. Tijerina said while he's working over 40 hours a week, meaning less time for friends and rest, for now he's okay with that sacrifice. He also commutes from Alpine to Marfa regularly and finds the route daunting and tiring at night. The effects of the pandemic could be a major factor in why some service industry workers are wary of returning to work, he said. The service industry is a place where people are packed together all day long. It's just like constant people and constant germs. For some, it could be that. I also think the customers have gotten a little bit more difficult, said Tijerina. More cash tips could help motivate more people to hold service industry roles, Tijerina said. But unfortunately, people are carrying less cash than they used to, partly due to the pandemic, he said. You have that cash right then and there. I think that's a great incentive to be in the service industry, said Tijerina. I mean, there's people with degrees who are doing bigger things, and at the end of the day, I could be making more money than them on certain days. Jet's Grill, the restaurant within the Hotel Paisano, is currently looking to hire 10 to 15 waiters and bartenders in order to be fully staffed, said Cy Wilson, front of house manager. Wilson, a native of Marfa, took over the role as front of house manager for the entire hotel last month and has been seeking new employees ever since. Despite a shortage of experienced front of house employees, the restaurant has continued to serve everyday customers and special events. We are a tourism town, so yeah, we have to keep it going, said Wilson. October has been a busy month for the Hotel Paisano, said Wilson, with back-to-back weddings almost every weekend. Wedding parties often split their time between the Paisano and St. George hotels, said Wilson, opting for a historical wedding but modern rehearsal dinner, for example. It works great because with the shortage of staff, it gives us a break, or if they need that extra money, they can help out with the other event, said Wilson. It is not uncommon for service workers to hold 2 to 3 part-time jobs in Marfa, since many businesses are not open enough hours to fill a 40-hour week schedule. Jets is offering $2 to $3 hourly pay plus tips for servers and a higher hourly wage for kitchen staff. Wilson said they are more willing to train inexperienced employees now versus before the pandemic started, but she has started to implement trial periods to make sure people are up for the gig after they fully understand the responsibilities and day-to-day. We need people. For me, it's an opportunity. I don't care where you're from. If you want that opportunity and that experience, we need those bodies. If you want to come and make money, well, then let's go for it. Let's do it. Because we are that tourism town. That's what we're based on now. After Wilson takes a moment to reassure a visitor about their bar hours, she goes back to discussing how offering varied experiences for guests can come as a challenge for a small staff. For example, keeping their regular dining room open while hosting a party for 100 guests in the courtyard. We have to accommodate because people come from everywhere. They want that Jets Grill experience, that pistachio fried steak that we're used to, the margaritas that we're known for, so you don't want to shut them down. So yeah, you get stretched thin, but we make do, we make it work, and I am very thankful for everybody here, said Wilson. Abby Boyd, Director of Tourism for the City of Marfa, said the events and gatherings that were canceled due to the pandemic are starting to happen now. I am aware of a lot of groups of visitors, especially weddings, making a return to Marfa. My understanding is that 2022 will be one of the busiest years in history for weddings, and I think Marfa is already starting to see that in 2021, said Boyd. Tourism has remained at a steady pace, said Boyd, but many local entities are still experiencing impacts of the ongoing pandemic. I also think people continue to see Marfa as a safe destination, since we are remote and have such a small population. Marfa didn't experience as big of an impact as larger Texas cities in terms of downturn in visitorship, said Boyd. With that said, I think some of our larger institutions are still proceeding with caution and moving a bit slower due to a lack of staffing. Those places are not yet where they were pre-pandemic. Insurance companies excavate Judd Foundation Architecture Office, Seeking Cause of Fire, by Abby Perot, ABBIE at BigBenSentinel.com. Marfa. Investigators sifted through the soot and debris within the Judd Foundation's architecture office late last week, seeking clues to the still unknown cause of the fire that consumed the under-construction building this June. The investigation is being led by Judd Foundation's insurance company, the Hanover Insurance Group, and other companies and contractors involved in the architecture office's historic restoration also have their insurance companies on site, monitoring the excavation on their behalf. In the wake of the fire, the work was done to stabilize the building's exterior. Last Thursday, work began with careful remediation to support the investigation to determine the fire's cause. We do not know the cause or origin of the fire, said a spokesperson for Judd Foundation. The scene on Highland Avenue was crowded on Thursday as workers from Cotton Global Disaster Solutions, a water damage and fire damage mitigation company based out of Katy, unloaded the contents of the building, pulling out charred tubifores and installing scorched HVAC equipment and shoveling piles of soot into heavy-duty black garbage bags. All of the debris will be preserved at storage facilities while the investigation continues. Representatives for the general contractors, the alarm company, the electricians, the plumber, and more were on site Thursday to witness the remediation, according to a Jed Foundation spokesperson. Marfa firefighters and police, who had been on scene in response to the June fire, also provided statements to the investigators, who are seeking answers to how the fire could have started, where it started, and how it progressed. "There's a suspected origin point," said Marfa Fire Chief Gary Mitschke on Thursday. "Based on what I saw, I know where I think the origin of the fire is. We're finalizing that determination and then determining what the ignition source was. It's progress. There's no guarantees we'll know exactly what happened. I'm looking to them for a final report and hopefully to understand what might have happened here." An investigator on the scene, who asked not to be identified because of confidentiality agreements, said, "Once you've got the origin, then you'll look into it as to what kinds of different sources of heat energy are present, if any, and then you collect evidence, and then we go to the laboratory after that." In searching for an origin, the investigator said they will check all electrical systems, mechanical systems, any tools battery pack being charged, chemicals present, leakage, and, quote, anything along those lines, end quote. He said it's typical to explore what kind of chemicals were involved, are they stored there, are they in the origin, and can they react with one another. The investigator also remarked that the fire appears to be typical. Once the origin and cause have been determined, the final question to be solved is, where does the fault lie? Only then can the various insurance companies begin dealing with the financial ramifications of the fire, the subsequent remediation, and the eventual restoration of the architecture office. For now, those answers are out of reach. The Judd Foundation said work is likely to last for 2 to 4 weeks, pending the arrival of additional materials and crew this week as remediation continues. Presidio ready to welcome back Mexican shoppers as border restrictions ease, by Sam Karras, Sam at BigBenSentinel.com. Presidio. Business owners and city officials alike have been waiting since the start of the pandemic for the return of one of the most significant forces in Presidio's economy, shoppers from Mexico. Back in March 2020, the Department of Homeland Security closed land borders to non-essential travel, dealing a devastating blow to border towns who depend on cross-border visitors. First couple of years, the Dollar Tree was open. You'd go in and half the license plates would be from Mexico and the other half would be from Texas, said City Administrator Brad Newton. Now you very rarely see a Mexican license plate anywhere. Newton stressed that local businesses aren't just feeling the burn, the city is too. In 2009, about 70% of our sales tax came from Mexican customers. Now, most of our sales tax comes from the increased cost of gasoline, he explained. For every gallon of gasoline sold in Presidio, the city earns 2 cents. That's why we like to have tourists and we like to have people shop at home, he said. Newton and other Presidio residents are quick to remind visitors that Presidio and Ojinaga are virtually one in the same. For most people, the restrictions haven't torn families apart. They've just put the burden on people from the U.S. side to cross, resulting in long waits in line on the bridge. For Presidio-based businesses, though, the Title 19 restrictions have been devastating. Azucena Romero, who manages the Dollar General with a view of the Presidio International Bridge, estimates that before the pandemic, about 70% of her business came from Mexico. There are two Dollar Generals in town, and hers gets the bulk of the international shoppers. I know our sales are going to be like they used to when the border reopens, she said. We are all going to benefit from it. Many of Romero's Mexican customers are people who own small businesses and vending stands who rely on her store to restock snacks and basic food staples. She has also noticed the absence of the Mennonite community, who once regularly crossed from their farming cooperative outside of Ojinaga into Presidio for a day of shopping and good food. Harper Hardware's Jose Sainz has owned his business since 1971, offering him a front row seat to ups and downs in Presidio's economy through many eras of border policy. Years and years ago, our business from Mexico was probably 90%, he said. Fluctuations in the peso and drastic restrictions imposed after 9/11 changed all of that. In the latest wave of border closures due to COVID-19, he estimates he lost about 10% of his current customer base. They come here for what they can't find over there, quality U.S.-made tools and materials, he said. I'm not one to complain, though. There will be more business and we will get some. The border is set to partially reopen on November 8th, according to the Department of Homeland Security. Travelers from Mexico will be required to provide proof of vaccination, but it's unclear exactly what that process will look like. We're still awaiting specifics from DHS, said Roger Mayer, public relations specialist for Customs and Border Protection in El Paso. The lifted restrictions mirror an easing of COVID-19 policies across the river in Ojinaga. City administration recently extended the hours bars and restaurants are allowed to be open until 2 a.m. The state of Chihuahua is still code yellow in its pandemic crisis response, with 1,330 confirmed cases in Ojinaga and 79 in San Carlos. Regardless of the reality of the pandemic on either side of the border, Presidio is ready for cross-border shoppers to return. Presidio is not in this alone. Every border community has suffered, Newton said. The Mexican shoppers are vital to border communities. We've been treading water and praying for their return. We are ready for our friends from Mexico to come back to Presidio.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, October 28, 2021. Council approves rental policy by Megan Waring. To start hosting events as soon as the facility is completely renovated, the city approved guidelines for when a client rents out the Fort Stockton Convention Center. On October 26th, the Fort Stockton City Council unanimously passed the facility's rental agreement, which includes the prices, responsibilities of the client, and cancellation policy. A bid to replace the HVAC system in the facility was also approved at Tuesday's meeting. The company's representative stated that it will take 30 to 60 days to install the new system. Mayor Chris Alexander said with the time frame on the HVAC installation in consideration, the convention center will likely be available for full use by the beginning of 2022. He added that certain spaces in the facility do have air conditioning working and may be available for use. Rental prices will vary for clients depending on the room selected for a specific event. Meeting rooms 1 through 3, 588 square feet, $150 a weekday, $200 a weekend, and $150 a weekday, $200 weekend for deposit. Meeting room 4, 476 square feet, $150 a weekday, $200 a weekend, and $150 weekday, $200 weekend deposit. All meeting rooms, 2,240 square feet, $500 weekday, $600 weekend, and $500 weekday, $600 weekend deposit. Main hall, 13,692 square feet, $1,000 daily with $500 deposit. Kitchen, 299 square feet, $250 a weekday with $250 deposit. Presentation room, 1,500 square feet, $250 a weekday and $250 deposit. Patio, $250 weekday, $250 deposit. Entire facility, $2,500 daily with $1,000 deposit. Holiday, $200 daily. Parking lot, $200 daily. As the facility was purchased to accommodate for multiple events, Councilmember Ruben Falcon said he does not want to see any scheduling conflicts, especially if it's a wedding on a Saturday night. My issue is that I don't want to handicap a facility that was bought for tourism and convention events. Traditionally, a lot of people want the key to start decorating almost on Thursday and Friday. Falcon added that the client should have access to the facility from 4 p.m. on the day before the event to noon the day after the event. We discussed that we are not going to do the whole key thing. We are going to do like you do at a motel with a swiper or key code. That way, at a certain time, that code or card expires and you are not able to get in past that time. Once your code expires, your time expires. You can't get in, you can't clean, and we keep the deposit. Clients will be responsible for cleaning up following their event. Decorations, trash, and other debris must be thrown away in the dumpster. Any cost to clean and or repair the facility will be charged to the client. All or a portion of the security deposit will be withheld if the facility is not adequately cleaned or there is any damage. To cancel a rental, client must provide written notice of the cancellation and the security deposit will be refunded in full. Amounts paid toward rental fees will be refunded according to the schedule. More than 90 days prior to the event, 100% refund. 60 to 90 days prior, 75% refund. 30 to 60 days prior, 50% refund. Less than 30 days prior, no refund. The council also discussed that for now, the convention center will only host weddings or quinceañeras one or two weekends per month. The city council also approved the stage rental policy for the convention center at their meeting on Tuesday. Clients can rent the stage daily, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. for $2,500 or for 2 days, 8 p.m. and beyond for $4,000. An additional $1,000 fee per day is required beyond the 2 day period. For the trailer stage to be reserved, a refundable security deposit of $500 plus 50% for the rental fee is required at the time the agreement is signed, and the remainder of the rental fee is required at least 30 days before the event. The city will provide delivery, setup, and teardown with a 2 mile ETJ radius of the city limits. Celebration announced at Horsehead Crossing. Pecos County Historical Commission Chairman Paul Weatherby announced a 2 day celebration at historic Horsehead Crossing on the Pecos River to be held November 5th and 6th. The event was first held in 2020 to commemorate the various historical figures who passed over this well known crossing throughout the 16th to 19th centuries, including the Comanche War Trail, the Immigrant Trail, and the Butterfield Overland Stage Trail, and the Goodnight Loving Trail, made famous by Larry McMurtry's Lonesome Dove. I contend that Horsehead Crossing is the second most iconic historic site in Texas, next to the Alamo, said Kirby Warnock. Every Texas historical figure has passed over this ground, from the Butterfield Stagecoach to the Goodnight Loving Trail. The popularity of last year's celebration, complete with chuckwagon breakfast, Storytelling and live fire demonstrations by historical reenactors inspired the commission to schedule a repeat performance. Details, vendor forms, and a complete itinerary of events may be found on the PCHC's website. There are also photos and videos of last year's event. Unlike the Alamo or many of Texas' historic efforts, forts, there are no structures standing at Horsehead Crossing. It's located in a remote area near present-day Girvan, with only a historical marker to commemorate the people who passed over the ground. As one of the few crossings along the Pecos River, it provided desperately needed water for stagecoaches, cattle herds, and travelers passing through the country. Reenactors will be available during the day along with live cannon fire. There will also be presentations by Tom Ashmore on the Butterfield stage line, as well as hosting walking tours of Horsehead Crossing. The celebration is being presented in conjunction with the PCHC, Crane, Presidio, and Upton County Historical Commissions and the Fort Stockton Historical Society. Horsehead Crossing is located on the Pecos River off Farm to Market 11 between Girvan and Imperial. For more information, email Delane Cagle at DelaneCC@gmail.com or Betty Dameron at BettyDameron986@yahoo.com. Bulletproof vests donated to local law enforcement. Local law enforcement will now be more protected after a generous donation of bulletproof vests. On October 22nd, Invest USA, a national nonprofit organization founded by military and law enforcement veteran Michael Letts, presented 20 vests to 5 Texas sheriff departments and the Fort Stockton Police Department at a press conference held at the FSPD headquarters. The sheriff offices have received vests were Culberson, Hudspeth, Pecos, Reeves, and Valverde counties. The vests cost $750 each and were provided by donations from private citizens as part of Invest USA's ongoing mission to provide bulletproof vests to all law enforcement and first responders in America. Law enforcement officers are on the front lines of keeping our citizens and communities safe. Invest USA is committed to doing everything we can to ensure these courageous men and women have the best resources for their personal protection. Texas law enforcement has a tough job because of the migrant disaster happening in on our southern border. These sheriffs and their officers exemplify the best in law enforcement today, and it is an honor to provide them with these vests. Fort Stockton Police Chief Robert Lujan said his department received 3 vests on October 22nd, and he hopes to get an additional 2 to 7 more. The police chief added that the vests provide additional protection to the vests that every officer already has. Each officer has their own personal vest. These here are active shooter vests, which is an added protection. You can throw them on top of your regular vest and they'll stop anything, any high-powered rifle out there.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahans News for Thursday, October 21st. Aggravated robbery suspect ordered to 8 years probation. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. A Monahans man, who was arrested for the June 2020 robbery of a shop at 109 South Main, has been sentenced to 8 years deferred adjudication for aggravated robbery. Deferred adjudication is a form of plea deal that enables a person to avoid a trial and possible conviction. The defendant can enter a plea of guilty or no contest to a charge in exchange for deferred adjudication, which means the judge doesn't find them guilty, but rather defers any finding of guilt in exchange for the acceptance of an alternative course of action. The defendant, 22-year-old Aaron Ruiz of 309 North Allen, waived his right to a jury trial and pleaded guilty to the crime on October 12th in the 143rd Judicial District Court. According to the indictment, on June 12, 2020, with intent to obtain and maintain control of the property, Ruiz threatened or placed Christian Joseph Hallman in fear of imminent bodily injury or death by exhibiting a black 9mm pistol and Ruger AR-15. Monahans Police Department Captain Christopher Quintana reported at the time the arrest of Ruiz came after he and another suspect, Manuel Fernando Enriquez Jr., age 22, of 1302 West 26th Street, allegedly walked into the shop on Main Street and displayed a weapon while demanding cash. Before fleeing the scene, the two stole a firearm from the building and took about $1,300 in cash. At the time, Ruiz and Enriquez were both named as suspects and arrested for the robbery and gun theft, but it wasn't clear as of press time if Enriquez had or would be indicted for the crime. Ruiz was also ordered to pay a $2,500 fine and $389 in court costs. 143rd District Attorney Randall W. Reynolds served as attorney for the state on the case. Broadband Phase 1 to be rebid. Earnest money released on East Side Apartment Complex. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. The Monahans Economic Development Corporation, or MEDC, approved several items related to the broadband project, including the rebid of Phase 1 construction of approximately 6 miles of fiber infrastructure during their regularly scheduled meeting on Monday. Carol Faulkner, with Faulkner Consulting, was on hand for the meeting and presented the status of the broadband project as well as the quarterly reporting associated with the $1.5 million federal EDA grant to the board. The board rejected the August bids associated with Phase 1 construction of the fiber infrastructure and voted to advertise for new bids. The new bid will be advertised beginning October 20th and due on November 6th. The MEDC previously received bids from Electricom, JKL, and Shalom Construction. The bids were substantially higher than expected. Faulkner said, quote, "The primary concern is that the price from all three contractors was $25 to $30 per FL and did not include material which the MEDC obtained separately. The cost of construction under any of these bids would approach $200,000 per mile," end quote. Board members decided that they could obtain better pricing through a rebid process and requested Faulkner to search for additional contractors. Quote, "Construction of the fiber loop should be less than $100,000 per mile, inclusive of materials. I have been in contact with several contractors who did not bid the project in August, and I anticipate the new bids will be in line with expectations," he said. Faulkner informed the group of the possibility for more grant funds available to Monahans for the broadband project through the $10 billion Rescue Act, where Texas has been allocated $500 million. Quote, "The grant guidelines align very well with Monahans. The U.S. Treasury guidance document says that the Treasury encourages recipients to focus on projects that will achieve last-mile connections. Recipients considering funding middle-mile projects are encouraged to have commitments in place to support new and/or improved last-mile service. Also, recipients are encouraged to prioritize investments in fiber-optic infrastructure where feasible, as such advanced technology better supports future needs. Treasury also encourages recipients to prioritize projects that involve broadband networks owned, operated by, or affiliated with local governments, nonprofits, and cooperatives, providers with less pressure to generate profits, and with a commitment to serving entire communities," he said. From the state's perspective, Faulkner anticipates that the newly formed Texas Broadband Office, headed by Greg Conte, could make application for the Texas Comptroller's Office on behalf of the state of Texas. Quote, Texas will be the recipient, however, the details of who will apply have not been worked out. The application launch portal was activated on September 24th, and the deadline to request funding is December 27. The grant process could be initiated in early 2022, with funds possibly available in late 2022 or early 2023. The period of performance ends December 31, 2026, he added. Chamber of Commerce Director Teresa Burnett has been communicating with State Senator Charles Perry and State Representative Brooks Landgraf to prioritize Monahans as a recipient for this funding. Quote, the Monahans Broadband Committee is proposing a Monahans allocation of 1% allocation, or $5 million, Faulkner said. Burnett is also coordinating efforts with the Texas Rural Funders Group and the Stillwater Foundation, who has already contributed to the Monahans project. These groups are initiating meetings in Austin so that Monahans can lobby for this funding in person. Burnett told the group she recently received an inquiry from a West Texas-based foundation interested in a financial contribution toward the Monahans Broadband Project. Monahans has already received financial contributions toward the Broadband Project totaling $725,000 from the Permian Basin Area Foundation, the Stillwater Foundation, the King Foundation, Chevron, Ward County, and the MEDC. MEDC board members present at the meeting included Brian Franks, Richard Irwin, Hal Upchurch, and Eddie Nelms. Newly appointed board member Renee Heflin was absent. In other business, the board agreed to release $5,000 in earnest money and a sales contract with Paso Construction, LLC. Imini Paso with Paso Construction put up the earnest money to secure lots 1, 2, 3, and 4 of Block 23 of the East Monahans subdivision on 15th Street to build a 20-unit apartment complex on the site. After a rezoning request from a single-family to multifamily was approved by the Planning and Zoning Board, the City Council voted unanimously to reject the zoning change in September when several citizens were on hand in opposition to the rezoning request. Quote, Paso expressed no interest in the lots if he could not rezone the lots to build an apartment complex, MEDC Director Ashley Adalto said. In regular business, the directors approved accounts payable totaling $8,900, which included $850 to Maverick Engineering for Monahans Parkway intersection flooding conveyance, and $8,000 for payroll and salaries, phone, insurance, maintenance, and fuel. The financial report reflecting a balance of $1.9 million in available funds and minutes of the September 27th regular meeting were approved. School trustees approve improvement plans. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. Anthony Agundis, Director of Special Education for Monahans Wicked Pyote ISD, presented the targeted improvement plan for Studerth Elementary during Monday's meeting of the Board of Trustees. Studerth Elementary is required to have a comprehensive improvement plan by Texas Education Agency because of a school rating of F. Target scores in areas of math, science, reading, and writing are at 80% of STAR tests for students to obtain approaching grade level. Scores in reading were 53%, math 65%, 54% in science, and 39% in writing. Quote, we are actually fairly close to meeting targets as only a few students are holding the scores down, Agundis said. the Sudarth Elementary leadership team has developed a draft plan with the assistance of Region 18 Service Center that has been reviewed and approved by TEA. Areas of concentration include developing roles and responsibilities for campus leadership, daily use of high-quality instructional materials aligned to instructional planning calendars, formative assessments, and data-driven instruction. The trustees approved the plan by unanimous vote. Trustees present for the meeting were Bobby Almanza, Raymond Reyes, Joel Greiner, Nancy Upchurch, and Steve Fine. Trustees Quint Melius and Donna Garcia were not present. Campus improvement plans for all district campuses were approved unanimously. Because of time constraints, the plans were not presented on Monday night, but the trustees had access to the plans, which will be posted on the school website. District Superintendent Chad Smith provided construction updates throughout the district as architects from Park Hill were not present for the meeting. Quote, "Things are moving along," Smith said. "The junior high fieldhouse renovation will begin in January 2022, and the new elementary school is still on target for completion in August 2022. Quote, "We are still waiting on some metal studs for the new elementary. Interior doors are finally in for Walker Junior High, but we are still waiting for some of the exterior doors. We are still on budget," he said. A budget amendment for $85,000 was approved for final payment of the new turf at the baseball field. The payment was budgeted last year, but was delayed because of poor workmanship of the field. This required moving the $85,000 to the current year. Quote, "We aren't going to pay it until the work is done right," Smith said. The total enrollment, as reported by the superintendent as of September 30th, was 2,119 students, up by 79 since the first day of school on August 18th. Walker Junior High School is up by 23. Monahans High School is up by 21. Tatum Elementary is up by 20. Cullender Kindergarten is up by 13. Monahans Education Center is up by 7 students. And Sudarth Elementary is down by 5 students. 5 local teaching certifications through the District of Innovation was also approved. The District of Innovation allows teachers to present instruction in a subject they are not certified to teach, one subject in a related field in which they are certified. Parents will be provided with written notice. The 5 individuals are Terry Galindo, MHS Spanish, Ashley Antrim, WJH-CATE, Shane Mayer, WJH Science, Dakota Ontiveros, WJH ELAR, Brooke Collinsworth, Tatum First Grade. In other matters, the December meeting of the trustees was moved from December 20th to December 13th because of the conflict with Christmas break. Minutes of the September 27th meeting were also approved. The next meeting of the trustees will be held on November 15th at 6:30 p.m. in the School Administration Building, 606 South Betty Street. Big Green Band advances to area. Twirling Ensemble and 4 Twirlers advance to state. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. The Black Gold Exuberant Marching Show earned Monahan's Big Green Band a Division I Superior rating at the UIL Marching Competition last Saturday, October 16th, at Ratliff Stadium in Odessa. The superior rating, a Division I from all 3 judges, will advance the band to the Area Marching Contest on October 30th at P.E. Shotwell Stadium in Abilene. Quote, "I am very proud of our performances on Saturday. It was our best performance to date. We got some good feedback from the judges, which pointed out some things we need to work on," Barrow said. Some of the judges' notes included individual marching, alignment on the field, musical nuances, and quality of performance. Monahan's band competed against Fort Stockton, Pecos, and Greenwood last Saturday. Region 6 is split into East and West, therefore Big Spring and Andrews will attend region contest this weekend. Quote, "The advancement to state is one band out of every five bands advance, so if 20 bands advance to area, then four bands will advance to state," Barrow explained. Normally, bands only advance to state every other year, but due to COVID last year, the state is allowing all classifications to advance this year. Former Texas band director Barry Hurt held a clinic with the band a few weeks ago to make improvements before contest. The band's show is titled Black Gold and depicts the many aspects of the Permian oil industry and West Texas. Leading the band are drum majors Kelly Franco and Evan Hernandez. "Judging for the area level of competition is different," Barrow said. Quote, "There are three music judges and two marching judges. The points are added from all judges and put together on a ranking for each band, such as the lowest total ranking score is first, the next lowest is second, and so on. Region band contest is judged against a standard using division ratings on a scale of 1 to 5, similar to those given to bands for concert and sight reading performance in the spring. These are defined as Division 1, Superior, Division 2, Excellent, Division 3, Average, Division 4, Below Average, and Division 5, Poor. Judges for the region's contest were Tammy Fednich, Dr. Ross Grant, and Dr. Dennis Hopkins. The Monahans High School Twirlers also fared well during the region contest last Saturday. The twirling ensemble and four of the five twirlers earned a Division I rating and a trip to state contest in May. Twirlers advancing to state are Milagros Armendariz, Bethany Montoya, Hope Santiago, and Gloria Vargas. Freshman twirler Isabella Nicholas received a Division II. The band will continue to focus on supporting the football team, which Barrow said is a very important part of what the band does. Quote, "We are excited to be able to keep supporting the Lobos and are happy we're having a winning season," he said. Early voting underway. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. Early voting started on Monday morning at the Ward County Clerk's Office with 8 constitutional amendments on the ballot. Early voting will continue from 8 a.m. until 5 p.m. Monday through Friday at the clerk's office until October 29th. The clerk's office is located on the first floor of the Ward County Courthouse, 400 South Allen. There are no local races. As of Wednesday morning, 12 ballots had been cast. On Tuesday, November 2nd, voters may go to their respective polling places as determined by their precinct. Polling hours will be from 7 a.m. until 7 p.m. Voters in Precinct 1E, 2, 3N, and 4E will cast ballots at the Ward County Event Center at 1525 Monahans Parkway in Monahans. Precinct 1W will cast ballots at the Barstow Community Center, 100 East Concho Street in Barstow. Precinct 3S will cast ballots at the Grand Falls Community Center, 711 North Avenue A in Grand Falls. Precinct 4M will cast ballots at the Wickett Community Center at 501 North O'Brien Street in Wickett. And Precinct 4W will cast ballots at the Pyote Community Center at 1108 North Ward in Pyote. Proposition 1 would amend the Texas Constitution to allow organizations sanctioned by the Professional Rodeo Cowboys Association or the Women's Professional Rodeo Association to conduct charitable raffles at rodeos. Proposition 2 would amend the Texas Constitution to authorize counties to issue bonds or notes to finance the development of transportation projects in the county. Proposition 3 would amend the Texas Constitution to prohibit Texas state and local governments from issuing an order or rule that prohibits or limits religious services, including religious services conducted in places of worship. Proposition 4 would amend the Texas Constitution to require state judges and justices to have more years of experience in Texas as a licensed practicing lawyer, state court, or county court judge without having their license suspended or revoked. Proposition 5 would amend the Texas Constitution to give the State Commission on Judicial Conduct the authority to accept complaints and reports regarding the conduct of candidates for judicial offices and to take appropriate disciplinary action upon investigation. Proposition 6 would amend the Texas Constitution to establish the right of residents of nursing homes, living centers, and similar facilities to designate an essential caregiver with whom the facility, residence, or center may not prohibit in-person visitation. Proposition 7 would amend the Texas Constitution to provide that the surviving spouse of a person who is disabled is entitled to continue to receive the homestead school tax limitation if the surviving spouse is 55 years of age or older when the disabled person dies. Proposition 8 would amend the Texas Constitution to provide the surviving spouse of a member of the Armed Services of the United States who is killed in action an exemption from property taxes of all or part of the market value of the surviving spouse's residence homestead if the surviving spouse has not remarried since the death of the member. County COVID cases continue to drop. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. The number of active COVID-19 cases continues to drop in Ward County, although at a slower pace than over the past 4 weeks. According to the Texas Department of Health Services, the number of active cases as of Wednesday morning was 104, down from 109 on Monday and 111 last Wednesday. The fatality noted last week has now been reported by DSHS, bringing the total to 27. The number of confirmed cases is now 1,264, with 624 probable and 1,757 recovered. County Judge Greg Holley said on Monday, quote, "Stable numbers, unstable politics. Numbers in Ward County remain stable. Government directives, on the other hand, are all over the board." Quote, "You may be as confused as I am regarding the various orders related to vaccine and mask mandates. While the federal government attempts to mandate vaccines, Texas has taken steps to prohibit such mandates. A similar battle continues in our state and others regarding mask mandates in schools. It's confusing to say the least. Don't worry too much about the politics. The ups and downs in the numbers appear to have more to do with variants pushing through a particular community than with college football games or family gatherings," end quote. The number of active cases in the state is also dropping. As of Wednesday, there were 135,514 active cases, down sharply from 167,000 last week. The number of deaths is now 68,043, with 3.47 million confirmed cases, 698,000 probable, and just under 4 million recovered.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.